Welcome to Merflies, everybody. I'm Ryan.
I'm Greg. And Josh is not here. I got to do it.
Yeah, you got to do it. So today we are doing something pretty interesting. We are going to be interviewing the head of the Logically app, which is a platform now that is dedicated to fact-checking using AI and a very dedicated team of investigators, along with a couple of software engineers. Lyric Jain is the founder of it, and we are extremely excited to be talking to him. There are a lot of topics that came up during this, and it really gets into the meta ethics of how to fact check, how we're living in a... Greg, how would you describe it? I don't know. We went through a lot.
Yeah, it really is about, one, what is their methodology? Like, just the nuts and bolts. Like, how do they assess credibility? How do you use their system? Like, what is it? Is it an app? Is it, you know, is it a plugin? All those things. But also, we kind of get into the question of, how do you treat the problem of misinformation? Ryan, it goes into some, I won't spoil too much, but you get into interesting virus metaphors, and how do you stop them at the source as opposed to treating the symptoms? And we get just a lot of very interesting conversations about how does this thing work and what is really the mission.
Oh, and there was something else involved. Oh, yeah, QAnon came back up.
Oh, yeah.
Logically was known for taking down QMAP, pretty much the most famous source for all of the Q drops without going to 8chan or 8kun. So we get a good insight on how his team did that and where Q is going in terms of tackling this situation, because as funny as Q can be, everybody, I'm going to say it straight up, it's dangerous. So, yeah. But anyway, we hope you enjoyed this interview. It's pretty long form, and Lyric has a lot to say, but I think it's extremely, extremely valuable to kind of like the viewpoint of the current socially minded or internet minded people.
Indeed.
Enjoy. Lyric Jain, very nice to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, awesome. Would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself before we get into the nitty-gritty of Logically?
Sure, absolutely. I'm Lyric. I'm 24. I've been in the misinfo, disinfo space for about 3-4 years now. And I live in the UK. I was in the US in a stranger, which was 2016, and both for some personal reasons, as well as the geopolitical mess that was 2016. Regardless of the results of the UK referendum and the presidential election, it felt like something was broken around how people consumed information online, and I thought we might be able to do something about it by building kind of at scale fact-checking capabilities, but also figuring out how we can use AI. So that's a really quick Cliff Notes version of here I am and what I do, but I'm sure we'll dive more into Logically.
So you bring up Logically. Can you kind of give us the quick rundown of what Logically is? Obviously, we're going to have the show notes. We're going to tell people about it. We'll have some links out to it. But what's kind of your elevator pitch for what Logically is and how it came to be?
Sure. So Logically fights misinformation at scale around the world. Kind of when people think about misinfo, disinfo, it's quite easy to pigeonhole this as, hey, it's just Facebook's problem or it's the government's problem, but it really isn't. It's a problem that we all face as consumers of information, because we've got to make day-to-day decisions about how we run our lives, how we vote, and many other important things. It's important for platforms because, as we know, they make a lot of decisions around what can be shown on their platforms, what can be downranked, what could be contextualized. And it's important for brands. Brands don't want to advertise next to problematic content. And finally, we have governments who are concerned about the public safety and national security risks associated with such content and activity. So slightly atypically, we don't pick one user group to support. We support stakeholders across those four groups. So we have the Logically app, which a lot of consumers use in the UK, India, and the US as a destination to try and fact check content, as well as to get kind of contextualized news from across the political spectrum. We work with platforms and various governmental bodies, especially around sensitive events, kind of elections and now pandemics, I guess, to help identify any kind of content that could be problematic, or any kind of external or domestic actors that might be trying to create some kind of chaos. And finally, more and more in the enterprise space, we work with kind of various ad networks, etc., and brands to make sure that for-profit disinformation is under control, so that all these outfits that originally came up around 2016, such as the Macedonian example that some of your listeners might be familiar with, that these kind of operations are somewhat under control, and that people don't just produce so-called fake news just to make a quick buck.
So I noticed you mentioned something in two different specific ways. You mentioned misinfo and disinfo. We have never actually talked about the difference between this on the show, but what would your definition of the two be?
Sure. I think the big thing to keep in mind here is intent. So misinformation is when there's just it's a piece of false information that someone, either an individual organization or a group of people, are just passing around between each other or publishing on just the open internet. Disinformation is when there's intent behind it. Either the creators of disinformation or key influencers who are involved in amplifying it, they know that what they're doing is either false or is problematic in some way. So it's when there's deliberate intent behind pushing certain narratives or artificially manipulating virality on social media in particular. That's when we'd put that more in the disinformation bucket. And when it is seemingly organic, it fits more into the misinformation bucket.
Gotcha. So if I'm going to understand correctly, AI is incorporated into the Logically system, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so I got a two-parter for you. What is the general role of it? And the second part is, ideally, with the way that Logically is operating right now with an app where people have to go to it at the moment if they want to make sure something is misinformation or not, or disinformation, ideally, is there kind of a long-term where, let's just say a scenario where there is a integrated verify button into social media platforms, just so when people see a post, they can click on it and see like that something is a tampered video or image or this keyword or key phrase has been used constantly in a disinformation campaign?
Yeah, I'll take both of those in turn. So I guess on the first one, we believe, especially when it comes to fact-checking and veracity, not just when we're guessing if something's true or false. So that's what we call our credibility assessment. It's effectively an educated guess at whether something's likely to be, whether something should be trusted or not. So for example, if Mr. Alex Jones from InfoWars is breaking a particular story and he's the only evidence source, it probably has a pretty low credibility because of his historic track record and just because of how poorly some of his reporting is evidenced. But on the other hand, if it's something that's come through the Reuters newswire, it likely has a very high credibility, and this is an assessment that we're purely making off the source. But we can make those same inferences based on various other things. But that's credibility. That's fully automatic, kind of finger up in the air, guessing whether something's likely to be true or not. What we mean by veracity or fact checking is when we're trying to make a more definitive assessment. And this is where we believe that there has to be a human somewhere involved in that process. We use a lot of AI both in identifying things we should fact check and in breaking them apart. And in some cases, kind of if it's visual content, using metadata and various forensic techniques to automatically break up fact checking and verification into an assembly line of tasks, some that are done by AI and some that are done by expert humans or individuals that have the right kind of domain expertise or the right kind of local and cultural understanding to be able to fact check content. So it's similar to, I guess, how a lot of defense departments in some ways use AI. There's always still a human that has to pull the trigger, that has to fire a missile. And it's, we believe, kind of facts and information can be just as potent if we're reckless with it. And we believe in the same way, an individual at the end of the day needs to be held accountable for pulling that trigger in terms of that definitive end assessment of whether something's true, false, or at present, based on available information, unverifiable. And we used then AI in various kind of distribution tasks as well. So for example, if there's 100,000 posts on Facebook out there that effectively say have the same claim, how can we use that one fact check to map it against all of those 100,000 posts. So AI kind of plays a multifaceted role. It's kind of this amplifier, but it also helps break fact-checking up into smaller tasks, some done by AI, some done by humans, instead of everything just lying on people's shoulders. Now for the second part, around platforms. Now that's probably an entire discussion in itself, because a lot of what we can do is limited by how our users want to use us. So when we work directly with platforms, a lot of our work is kind of behind the scenes and offline. It doesn't necessarily reflect itself in product. Different platforms are taking kind of a very different approach around how they deal with problematic content and the various flavors of it, how they deal with misinfo, how they deal with disinformation, hate, and content likely to cause real world harm. So they're fairly nuanced policies right now, and some are incredibly protective of the First Amendment, such as Facebook. Others are, shall we say, a bit more risk averse and wanted to get rid of anything that could be problematic from their platform. So at the moment, that's something we don't control directly. And it's not something that end users can control directly. Our view is that this is something similar to like privacy standards. Like right now, you can go onto your Facebook, Twitter, Google, whatever, and do a bunch of check boxes around how you want your privacy settings to be. And we believe that that's probably a good way of thinking about some of this kind of content as well. So me personally, I love seeking some of this content out just because I want to understand how what some of these fringe communities around the world are thinking, what narratives are prevailing within them, just for my own kind of slightly weird curiosity. But other people I appreciate might want a cleaner social media feed where all they want is just incredibly reliable mainstream information. So I think it's platforms are taking a slightly ambitious approach right now, where they just want to be judge, jury, and make this centralized control of what's visible to various users. But I think in reality, our tastes and preferences when it comes to some of this content can be radically different. And a longer term solution for these guys to consider might be personalizing some of this and giving that power to end users so that they can control what happens on their own feeds. And when it comes to kind of big, really harmful stuff, deal with it kind of like we already deal with stuff such as child pornography or terrorist content. Completely take that down from your platform, of course. So I think, I know that was a pretty long two-part answer, but hopefully that addresses those questions.
As somebody who also shares the same masochistic interest of diving into those communities to keep a pulse on it, I sympathize on that front. It is very difficult to keep ahead of the game because, I mean, you see so many things, and usually when it gets into some sort of like mainstream platform, they're about a month behind with a lot of the narrative that's going on, and the answers to a lot of these misinfo or disinfo campaigns have changed, and it's not even a concern for them anymore. So that, I think, would be definitely a very big virtue to having AI implemented in this, because it can keep up much faster and save, I imagine, a couple of people's mental health. That being said, I guess from a philosophical standpoint, you can sometimes, at least I like to see fake news or disinformation as a virus, where it's best to prevent it rather than correct it. And it seems that once the infection starts, it's much harder to treat and fix. Like, once the first story gets out, that's the one that's going to be seen the most. Rarely ever is the correction getting as much attention as it should. So the question is, with a lot of these campaigns, like let's take QAnon, which we'll get into soon. With that type of messaging where there is no intrinsic value to it that is good for the world, do you take an approach of these things should be deplatformed as soon as possible, or should there be an active let them speak and get their narrative out so we can take care of it and explain why it's wrong? Because from my standpoint, it does sound a little bit Minority Report, but it's much easier to say you want a burger from McDonald's or something, but the McDonald's is 20 miles away. You're going to go ahead and probably eat something at home if you're lazy enough. That's the same way with seeking out this harmful information that isn't even true. Do you think it's best to go from a deplatforming standpoint once you know this stuff is fake, or keep letting it do a controlled trickle out so you can handle it as it comes out?
That's a great question. And I think My answer is going to be something that an engineer says a lot. It depends. I think firstly, it depends if this is a closed platform or an open platform. So an open platform would be a Twitter or a public Facebook. A closed would be private Facebook groups, WhatsApp, Telegram, Messenger, those kind of things. I think there's different levers and controls we have and platforms and governments, et cetera, have on them. And that's an important distinction to make, because a lot of these communities are already migrating away from major platforms, or at least the open side of those major platforms, into very private groups or into messaging networks. So whatever we can do, or whatever the platforms themselves can do, becomes quite limited in terms of outright deplatforming and takedown. My personal preference and kind of medium to long term would be finding a way in which we could have greater media literacy and digital literacy across the population, across all demographies, where we can finally allow some of this content that isn't very dangerous, that doesn't result in imminent harm. We can allow some of that. We have a space effectively being on every platform where we can allow that to be open, make sure that it's contested quickly and quickly and at scale, and let it stand on its own merits. And the mechanism we see here, which is quite prominent, is how the in-group or the already radicalized react to that piece of information and all attempts at fact-checking it, and how everyone else responds to it. I think one of the points you made was probably one of the best criticisms you can make of everyone that's attempting fact-checking, and it's that it comes out too late. So the piece of misinformation has already gone to kind of a million people by the time a fact-check's published. And fact checks, more often than not, are preaching to the choir. It's preaching to people who probably don't care about what Logically or Snopes or PolitiFact or anybody is saying about a particular claim, because they already have formed their opinions and they're quite deep rooted. So the way I kind of look at it, and more generally, I guess a lot of people in the industry look at it, is it's more a mechanism to prevent virality. So extending that virus analogy, how do we test and trace frequently enough such that when these messages and narratives and kind of fake documentaries and whatnot are getting out of these closed groups or wherever they're originating from into the wider public, how do we develop an early warning mechanism that tells us what it is and kind of inoculates the rest of the public against it, either by through notifications, through fact checks, or by kind of downranking that kind of content and those kind of narratives. So I think that's been the mechanism that we've seen to be most effective. But there's a lot more work to be done in that direction, because it's easy to think of a lot of these communities as being kind of one kind of Goliath type community that behave in very similar ways. But they all have their own unique nuances and traits and ways to kind of market whatever that narrative they're producing. There's this Plandemic documentary, I think back in when was it? May, was it?
Yeah.
And it was marketed almost as a very traditional movie, but only in certain communities. So, and it's a shame that platforms didn't catch it quicker, because it was so obvious what was going on and the scale at which it was going on. But thankfully, we learned, and everyone else learned who's involved in a similar space. And when the sequel to that documentary came out, I think 2 months after that, it really flopped. In kind of every major platform, YouTube, et cetera, took it down within seconds. And even Twitter and Facebook weren't really allowing too many links to external websites that were hosting that documentary to be posted. So all the fizz and the early virality that really makes this kind of stuff harmful and get mass market traction, that kind of sting was taken out of it. So I think that's a good way in which we can balance a lot of concerns that people have around how do we prevent harm, but also how do we respect their First Amendment rights, and how do we allow people to, within reason, do whatever they want to do online.
You had this really interesting take earlier, and I'm not sure it's exactly what you meant by it, but you said it's all our problem. This is very early in the discussion here, and it's an interesting take to me because it kind of presents this issue where it seems like individuals are punting when they say it's Facebook's issue, right? So we're like discussing all these solutions and whose responsibility it is and what can logically do and what can Facebook do. But do we also need to attack it from almost a culture standpoint? Do we need to change people's behavior and make almost a, for lack of a better term, an informed internet citizen, right? Someone who understands how to, like you said yourself, y'all kind of have this immediate credibility rating you give things, right? And I think a lot of people with more experience on the internet, this might just be egotistical of me, but we like to think that we can kind of make a snap judgment sometimes, right? If I see Alex Jones or I see, you know, what's that very popular Russian site, the news site,
RT.
Sputnik? Yeah, yeah, RT and them. And so it's like, out the gate, I immediately know that I need to go search for two or three other sources just immediately, right? But is there a way, and should we try to engender a certain culture and this informed internet citizen and kind of this ability to at least increase the baseline gullibility, right? Or rather decrease the gullibility and increase the strength of these people. Or is it all up to platforms like Facebook or efforts like yours with Logically? I mean, does it need to be more holistic, or do we really need to just treat people like children, for lack of a better term?
No, I think long term it needs to be holistic. The analogy I sometimes use is that right now all these actions, what we're doing, Facebook's doing, these are like painkillers. It's curing the symptoms. Or treating the symptoms and making people go pain-free, but it's not a vaccine, it's not an ultimate cure. And the ultimate cure really is kind of this, having this culture shift where culture shift and skills push, because it is a skill, kind of learning how to think critically and learning how to interrogate media and having, being skeptical of the things you hear and you read and watch. It's a skill that needs to be learned, because the flip side of this is that these are the exact skills that a lot of these conspiracy theory and fringe communities, they believe they have the best of these skills because they have the outlier opinion. They believe they've out-reasoned every smart person on earth and are the first to discover this greater truth. So the reason why there is that dissonance and failure is because they haven't taken, it's almost that they have imperfect skills and incomplete knowledge. And in a lot of cases, that's more dangerous than people haven't gone through a formal training and education in that. And I think not just kids, we need all age groups to have those basic set of skills. Hey, how do we look at information? How do we look at information coming from various sources, from domestic sources, international sources, and even domestically? How do you distinguish between a kind of Carl Bernstein and an Alex Jones? How do you distinguish between at a lower a bandwidth of difference between what an MSNBC is going to say about something and what a Fox is going to say about something? So it's I think there is a degree of exhaustion here to consider as well. Not everyone is going to have that time, the interest, or the capabilities to be able to go through 3, 4, 5 sources about something to get everything corroborated. And that's where various crutches that we're building, Facebook are building, come in. If it is that problem. But I think we need to long-term get into a position where this is highly ingrained into education systems and other ways of skilling people up, because by making all of this just Facebook's responsibility, we're putting them in an incredibly powerful position where effectively they become the arbiters of truth, them and their fact-checking partners. And right now, to that credit, they're not abusing that power. They're taking on the responsibilities and losing a lot of money with advertiser boycotts and whatnot to defend freedom of expression while keeping their platform safe. But it's those are the kind of trade-offs that need to be guaranteed by some kind of regulation. It can't just be up to the leader of the organization, but for Mark or anyone else to come up with that. With the limits on that trade-off, it needs to be something that government needs to get involved in, NGOs, civil society, everyone needs to get involved in to try and regulate, because this used to be an incredibly unpopular idea, but since 2018 now, platforms themselves have been outright calling to be regulated. When has that happened before? An industry companies within an industry calling for themselves and their functions to be regulated. So they're feeling the pressure, and I think we would there'd be a lot of societal good that come from some thoughtful and careful legislation going into the space.
Just to get a little bit of a view from you about the Facebook thing really quickly. So you do think that Facebook is taking a little bit more responsible measures, because I don't know if everybody knows this, but there was a big campaign on Facebook that kind of led to a little bit of a potential ethnic genocide in Myanmar and Ethiopia. We saw rising tensions there recently. Do you think their response to that has been largely properly corrective?
Not fully. I'd say they're trying. And in terms of platforms that are trying, they're probably trying the hardest. I'll make a point around platform size slightly later. I think they've been improving consistently, especially since early 2018. They probably didn't take this problem seriously enough anywhere in 2017, but there's been large teams that have been born out of nothing over the last 2 years and are continuously being set up to fight some of these challenges at scale. I think what they do a slightly worse job of, or not necessarily worse job, but they a controversial job sometimes, is when it comes to the more high profile cases. So sometimes knowing how to deal with, say, the president's posts or some high-profile politicians in other countries, their position is very much towards leaving things posted up in the general public interest, regardless of harm, especially if it's coming from an individual with a position of power, something that could have geopolitical consequences. That's the trade-off that they typically make, whereas someone like a Twitter, I think it's incredibly poor at fighting misinformation at scale and a lot of the other types of harms at scale. But it does seem to walk a very different line on the high profile cases. It prioritizes kind of safety over free expression. And again, based on various individuals, their values and their kind of own perspective, they're going to believe either Facebook's doing a better job in the high profile cases or Twitter. But I think we make a fallacy when we compare those two organizations themselves, because there's about a 10-15x difference in their market caps, and equally there's a 10-15x difference in how many resources and how much resource they can dedicate towards these problem areas. And again, this is again a reason why some of these functions need to be brought out of these platforms, because it's Facebook can maybe do it. They can kind of forget almost all of their profit margin and employ an awful lot of content moderators and fact checkers around the world, but no other organization can, not even Google. So we need to figure out slightly more sensible ways in which a lot of these platforms can share the burden in some kind of either a public body or a free market of kind of information and risk assessors who these platforms lean on, because it's imagine a Reddit right now, right? It's a Reddit can't have the same size of platform trust and safety team that a Facebook does, and even if they wished to, some of the smaller forums, say in the UK, we've got Mumsnet, it's just a forum for mothers. They have nowhere near the resources of Facebook, but are incredibly important when it comes to certain conversations and certain bits of information that people seek out. So it's we need to take the problem away from one single organization, make it all of our problems, because we experience it in different mechanisms, both regulatory and kind of things that we can do in terms of process and in terms of building out operating capacity. And then we're still dent on the problem. Right now, I think too much is riding on shoulders.
It's really quick, if you don't mind. It's interesting you bring up Reddit, because like there's such a great example of watching via a single platform the transition of like, or just really the change up of how people view information and trust in communities on the internet. Because, you know, this is a little semi-anecdotal, but you can definitely see this in the rhetoric of their leadership and in the way their policies have changed over the last 10 years. That Reddit had a much more high-minded kind of bastion of free speech mentality, because they ultimately believed that the crowd would kind of not self-police entirely, but that ultimately through their algorithm and voting system that it would kind of work out. And as it went on, you saw, like, I remember when they banned their first subreddits and that being like a grenade going off in the room, right? It was this complete 180 in some ways. They were building to it if you're paying attention, but it really was the first formal rejection of kind of their old stance, right? They really didn't police it unless it got illegal. And as they've gotten bigger and as efforts online have changed, their stance has become increasingly hardline to now banning subreddits is like a regular thing they do. It's very interesting. They even like had to dip their toes in with like quarantining subreddits, right? They had to like make it more palatable. Just an interesting watching that platform specifically as it became a top 10 website in the world become tighter. Very interesting process.
Absolutely. And they solved very much. Oh, sorry, Greg. And they kind of solved partially their problem by this policy tweak. But then it resulted in all these chans popping up. So kind of societally, we didn't solve the problem. Reddit kind of just moved the problem away from their platform. Because after those moves, that's when chans, there were chans even during the early days, but it's only after that move that we started seeing significant traffic go to various chans, kind of 4chan, 8chan, and all the other chans that are out there.
Yeah. Well, it's like red light district theory, basically.
So, moving on to the chans aspect of things, one last question about an idea of logically before we get into the big drama of Qmap. But one of the big things about Q is that they don't have to stick to their guns. They can just change things. It's gone from the point where it's less of a focus on Q to the point in the most recent Q drops, Q has specifically said, don't mention us as much, just actually go with the principle. And the principle is starting to be shed from this idea of like a deep state, the Donald Trump's in the government trying to save the world, to a straight up repainting of the Jewish blood libel with the Save the Children movement, which is largely tied to Q, just with a little bit more user-friendly face. Now, there's some things that they like to tout, like for instance, 800,000 children go missing every year. Now, they're not wrong when they say this, but they don't say that most of them are found because they ran away for 2 days to go see their friend's house because they were mad at their parents. This is a weaponized partial truth that people can use to sway somebody over. Does logically have a policy for how to handle these types of issues where it's not wrong, but it's also not complete?
100%. You've hit on my second criticism of fact-checking world, and that is literal fact-checking as opposed to narrative fact-checking. So again, perhaps even we were probably blamed for this maybe 18 months ago, and we would probably have fact-checked that statement very, very literally and said, yes, this is true. And we wouldn't have presented too much context around how that particular statement or that narrative was being weaponized. So I think this is something that overall the fact-checking industry is struggling with. I think we might be doing a slightly different job in that we all our fact checks, we try and contextualize them with a nugget of information that makes them more relevant to whatever wider narrative around that those claims might be. That still opens us up to kind of our historic fact checks being weaponized later and used to support all kinds of narratives. But the quick solution in those cases would be for us to be very active in recontextualizing them based on whatever narrative that whatever misleading narrative they were being used to support. So I think the larger question here is how do we kind of fact check narratives when they as and when they appear, even though those narratives rely on facts, they rely on but they also omit key facts that would completely change the greater picture. So I think that's something that we do a fair bit of, but it's something that we could be doing more of, because I'm not sure if it's happened too many times for us, but a lot of fact checks by organizations do get weaponized by a lot of these communities, and it's where facts aren't sufficient or a fact isn't sufficient. I remember reading about this or a lecture telling me this almost in my first week at university, and it was, if you look at facts, or if, it was more precisely, if you look at data long enough and hard enough, it'll tell you it loves you. And a similar thing applies to facts. You can connect any sequence of facts together to make up whatever you want. But it's the selective, if you're being very aggressive in which ones you pick and which ones you omit, there you go. You've made a massive mistake there. And most people don't, not most, a lot of people don't have the skills necessary to know when they're omitting or when they're, when what they're reading is omitting key facts. But I think that that's an important part of what we try and do with the other side of Logically Consumer, which isn't as fact-checking heavy. So that's kind of the news consumption side of Logically, where we try and present users with an objective summary of whatever events happened and contextualize it with at least three perspectives from across the political spectra. Again, it's imperfect because things don't always divide cleanly into left, center, and right. But it's that's kind of where we want to go with a news experience. How do we find kind of the objective nuggets of truth that lie that underpin any story, and look at how various narratives are being spun off by selectively choosing different bits of information from it. So that's more, I think, a way to change the way in which we consume information and news, rather than something that just fact-checking world should be responsible for.
Okay. So now let's talk about how Logically managed to cut themselves a nice little place into what the QAnon community would like to call the Great Meme War. Your team has now famously revealed the identity of the creator of QMap.pub, pretty much objectively, aside from Q himself, the easiest resource for people to find out what's going on with Q. And you revealed this man, QAnon, to be a man named Jason Galinas, a New Jersey software engineer, I want to say?
Information security analyst.
Okay. Yeah. So what was the decision that led to you guys deciding to go after QMap specifically? And can you give us a brief rundown of how Jason Galinas was revealed to be QAnon? Because currently, QMap.pub is down.
Yes, absolutely. And again, this is a really interesting example of, I think, what is possible just with a degree of real-world accountability for digital activities. I think it's our aim here was to further understand what's happening behind QMap, because usually pre-QMap, people used to have to go all the way to Aitken, which isn't the most elegant place in the world. Messy narratives content, even the most entrenched individuals within QAnon would disagree with or have qualms about. That's where that was kind of the primary destination before all these aggregator sites popped up. And the biggest one of those was QMap. We decided to kind of understand what the infrastructure behind QMap was and who the individuals who might be operating it are, because I think I'm right in saying this, that since about April, it received around 10 million visits every month. And that's a significant increase in the amount of eyeballs that Q and was indirectly or directly getting.
Thank you, COVID.
So we made a decision to kind of investigate further and just shine a light of accountability on whoever the individuals behind it might be. So for individuals not familiar with Q law, the law behind Q is that it might be an individual who comes from somewhere deep into military intelligence, which is honestly probably a load of poppycock, but it's that's the law behind it. So if it's such a kind of supposedly powerful individual that is so deeply entrenched into our into the world of intelligence, they're not going to be relying on a software developer / info security analyst that works for a bank to set up their most powerful and most potent aggregator. So it's an attempt to expose this whole thing as either an individual who's doing this for geopolitical aim, an individual who's doing this for profit, or an individual that's just an agent of chaos who's just getting off of doing this. So I think one of the most effective ways in which we found de-radicalization works is shining that accountability on whoever the figurehead of a lot of these theories and conspiracies are. If they are irrefutably known to be doing this for less than ideological reason, shall we say, for profit, because Jason, I believe, had set up certain GoFundMe or GoFundMe equivalents that he was making a few thousand dollars off every month. It leads people to think again around how they came to believe certain things. So that was the entire kind of reasoning behind doing some of the work that we did. More specifically around how we were able to attribute QMAP to him. It was the work of two of our investigators in particular. A lot of other people in the team, I'm sure, helped. And we had a lot of tips that came in from various people who've been following Q for a lot longer than we have, around various indicators of compromise around servers and mainly around servers that were being used to post things to QMAP. And just by correlating those with various other indicators we had and we continuously source, we were able to quite confidently attribute this to Jason. And I think the next day, when we shared this with a few of our friends at, I believe, Bloomberg, one of their journalists decided to, or reporters decided to question Jason around why he was doing this. And I believe that just asking those questions to an individual who's behind something so potent made him realize perhaps that there's real world consequences for some of this chaos that he's enabling digitally. And he made the decision himself to, I don't believe there was any takedowns that were that were taken on by any third parties. I believe it was him who ended up taking the website down. So I think it's an example of what just a degree of real world accountability, nothing too major, can do just to get these guys to reconsider their actions, to know that their actions and their consequences don't just happen in a vacuum or aren't just limited to the digital world, but are also involved in the real world. And these guys have been having a lot of real world impact. I think there's a few, there's quite a lot of violence, and I think even a few murders that are attributable to QAnon generally. Yep. So I think it's high time that certain individuals started to be held accountable.
Okay, so with that being said, number one, thank you for you and the people on your team for taking a part in chopping off at least one big head of the Hydra. We know others will pop up, but this is helpful. Secondly, does Logically have any plans for our favorite pig farmer in the Philippines, Jim Watkins, who has created his own little reality ecosystem and essentially is controlling the Q narrative right now just by all of the stakes that he has in the whole thing? He runs 8kun, he was hosting Q Maps for a while, and he seems just to be trying to keep the lifeline going. Have you guys thought about any way to deal with those type of like contained ecosystems of information?
So it's kind of twofold. So this is an example where we know the individual's real-world identity, and they're still persevering, and he's a man on a mission, right? So it's unlikely, again, just because people already know who he is, it's unlikely we're going to be able to do something using the same strategies as Jason. But what we do otherwise is just work more closely with platforms to try and limit the impact that he could be having. So as part of what we sometimes help them with is threat intel, and he is a figure who clearly is a threat just because of how closely he's linked to a lot of this activity. So whenever we identify anything new that he might be doing, we warn some of our partners that hey, just take the appropriate actions in terms of moderation and downranking that you might need to take based on their own policies to limit the harms that might be caused by this individual's actions. More generally, we're continuing our work around Q to try and attribute and investigate the early stages of the development of Q and the entire narrative around Q. And again, there's hopefully some news where we'll be able to share with you in not too distant future around that.
Oh, we will definitely love to have you back if you get some more on that. Because it's funny how, like, you know, the old people, the old guard, like Coleman Rogers, and I forgot what the other guy's name. His name was Baruch the Scribe on 4chan. But now Jim, I mean, people think that he's Q himself. And it's the evidence is, there's some evidence there so far, but he definitely has a very big investment in this whole thing staying alive.
So this last question is kind of a little more philosophical, but I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are, because I feel like it would play into how you view your mission in a lot of ways. So a lot of times, and this is kind of my own personal take, a lot of times people are acting as if, you know, we say opinions are facts, right? We talk about alternative facts, and people are saying, oh, people are treating opinion as fact, and all opinions are now considered equal no matter how ridiculous. But I think another side of the problem is that other people's facts are being treated as opinion, right? They're being denigrated. So if you can write off the opposition as just having an opinion and that their experts are not trustworthy or biased in some way, the mission of fact-checking becomes almost an impossibility, because I reject Snopes, I reject Wikipedia, I reject logically, right? I say that these are their opinions and it's just their interpretation of events, and I have my sources and they're just as good as your sources, and really stripping down even the core concept of an expert, right? So do we need to change our entire concept of even what a fact check is? Because if a fact check is just a bunch of people who agree with each other on the same sources, and that's not reaching the people it needs to reach. Not necessarily you need to find the deepest Q-pilled person and get them to convert to the light side, right? It's not even that intense. It's more people who are trying to find good information and they don't know where to find it. How do you get this information into those hands? How do you win the hearts and minds of people with what you believe is as close to the truth as you can get and good due diligence? I know it's a very long-winded question. I just feel like, I know it's a lot of propping there, but you know, it's kind of, all this stuff kind of gets connected in these alternative facts and things like that.
No, completely. And again, we don't want to denigrate the value of opinions. Opinions are incredibly powerful. Everyone has opinions, and we use a lot of those opinions to lead our lives. Again, it kind of comes from bias as well, right? Everyone, we all have biases. Most of us, when we come across a lion, we'll take a step back. We don't know who that lion is. We don't know if they're house trained. We don't know all the facts around that lion. He might be the most pleasant lion in the world. But we, from our evolution, know and have certain biases that are just built into us, and we will step back from that lion and not go running towards it. So it's I think, regardless of the information that you have, I think it depends on how much of a risk you're willing to take in having a certain position, because it's as soon as you sway away from whatever, say, a piece of consensus might be, you are taking an outlier position. Sometimes it's great to be an outlier, but not always, and especially say when it's to do with something scientific. A lot of people during COVID times have kind of used COVID as a way of bashing experts all over again. Hey, masks are irrelevant one day and masks are the most important thing the next day. And people use that to kind of bash experts. But from someone who studies science, and a lot of people study science in the world, and that's the beauty of the scientific method. It's not an outcome, it's a process. But not enough people acknowledge it as a process. There will be periods of uncertainty, and we need to be better at communicating how much uncertainty there is over certain theories and over certain things we believe to be as close to the absolute truth at any given moment in time. But that improves over time, and science is the process through which people can interrogate any specific a theory and either elevate it by validating it, or come up with contrary evidence that rips it to shreds. And that is the beauty of science. And I think the same kind of applies when it comes to facts or so-called facts or loosely opinions as well. If people are going into it with an open mind and want to seek out the truth, in a case where there is a final truth. I think that the role of fact checking is to get people or get the world's understanding, our collective understanding, as close to that as possible. Now, the second part of what you asked was more of a communication challenge more than a process challenge. So fact checking, information changes. Presently available information, we need a process through which most people can, by scanning through all available information, come to a reasonable conclusion that most people would agree on, again, based on available information. And we can't fact check opinions. We can only fact check kind of factual assertions that people are making. The communication part of this is the more tricky challenge, because it comes back to that in-group or radicalized group piece that I was mentioning earlier. You can throw as many facts at certain people as you want. You're not going to be able to change their minds. And I don't think that necessarily should be the goal. I think the role that fact-checking is playing today is almost a security and safety role in some cases. People are entitled to believe whatever they want. They want to go walk towards Antarctica to discover some hypothetical edge of the world. Go, I mean, I have no qualms against it. But I think the fact checking starts playing a role when those actions of those individuals who have these very fringe views start having a negative impact on the rest of us. I think that's where fact checking and more generally a lot of these moderation practices need to play a role. Allow all of the rest of us to come up with a sense making function and prevent kind of these grenades and viruses from being lobbed at us by a lot of these fringe communities. I think long run, the only way to kind of de-radicalize an individual is building trust, and unfortunately, not a lot of that can be done online. It's kind of in person, tough conversations, and trust building, and over time, we can perhaps lead people on a breadcrumb journey away from a lot of these wacky ideas. But I think people believing in wacky ideas in itself isn't a huge problem, as long as it doesn't affect the people around them adversely. So I think we perhaps need to just get better at understanding which challenges we want to really go after, what kind of information and what kind of behavior online could lead to offline harm or online harm, and which ones are relatively innocuous and ones that we should probably just leave to one place, because deplatforming and taking down a lot of these communities does have a backfire effect of them becoming even more extreme and going underground. Mm-hmm. And we've started to see that with a lot of these kind of free speech platforms. So I think we just need to get better at assessing risk and making the decisions we make around deplatforming and the role of fact checking as strategically and carefully as we can.
Thank you, Lyric, for sitting down and speaking with us. Is there anything else that you'd like to include or mention that we may have skipped over? And also, how can people find you or find out more about Logically?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, right now, the thing at the top of all our minds is the election that's just over a month away now. So I think the most important thing for people to do between now and then is to be incredibly vigilant. Because the amount of misinformation and disinformation that's going to be flowing through every single network between now and the election, on election day, and immediately after the election is likely to be unparalleled. We're in for something quite special in a very crazy way. So I think we need to be vigilant. We need to find people we trust and sources that we trust. And people are struggling to do that themselves, we're here, happy to help through various things that we do as an organization. There's our app and extension, etc., that people can continue to use. One quick thing that I should mention there is, even if it's an individual from one of these communities who has fringe beliefs, or if you just believe we've got a fact check wrong, we have a very, very strict process that we implement internally where you can question and ask for a correction for any of our fact checks, and we'll get back to you within kind of within a 2 to 3 day working window, and we enforce that very, very rigidly internally. So to all the Q people out there that might be listening to this, go ham, report as many of our fact checks that you believe to be unfair to your opinion or your stance in the world, and we'll make sure we get back to you to let you know why we continue to believe in the veracity of our fact check, or to issue a correction. And I'm being honest when I say
this. So, look, I'm gonna have to say this real quick. We have a policy at Rumor Flies where at the end of every season, if some people found that we said something not factual, we have to correct it by taking a penalty shot, which is a terribly tasting drink of any sort. If you implement that logically, do you think that that would make better vigilance for the team so they don't have to do something like that?
I think I'll be about 10 or 11 shots down, given all the fact checks that we've done, about 12,000. So I'll be 10 or 11 shots down. So I think over a 2 year period, I'm okay to take them. Or if we could maybe make it a collective shot for everyone on our team.
There we go. So how can everybody reach you? Just the Logically app in general is the best place for that?
Yes, absolutely. If you're interested in the space, kind of from an investigations point of view, I think our managing editor Al Baker, he's the best person to reach out to. If you're just curious about this space, because this space has really exploded over the last few years, just feel free to reach out to me. I might not be very responsive over the next month and a half, but I'll certainly get back to you before Christmas for sure. And you can reach out to me. Kind of, it's a fairly easy enough email address: lyric@logically.co.uk or logically.ai. And same with Al. And other than that, we're on social media as well. So feel free to reach out to us there. Just stop accusing us of being funded by Bill Gates, because we're not.
Yeah, you're stealing our Bill Gates money. Okay, stop that. So
what's the credibility rating on that statement?
So Lyric, if you ever feel like coming and spewing some more information at us, we will be glad to have you. But until next time, please stay well, and thanks for talking.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.